Billy. After they had checked into room 14 at the White Peaks Motel on Route 28, and Billy had taken off his backpack, Emmett said he was heading out to find Wooly and Duchess. In the meantime, he told Billy, it's probably for the best if you stay here. Besides, said Sally, when was the last time you took a bath, young man? I wouldn't be surprised if it was back in Nebraska. That's true, said Billy, nodding. The last time I took a bath was back in Nebraska. As Emmett began talking quietly to Sally, Billy put his backpack back on his back and headed toward the bathroom. Do you really need that thing in there with you? Sally asked. I need it, said Billy with his hand on the doorknob, because it's where my clean clothes are. All right, but don't forget to wash behind your ears. I won't. When Emmett and Sally went back to talking, Billy went into the bathroom, closed the door, and turned on the bathtub faucets. But he didn't take off his dirty clothes. He didn't take off his dirty clothes because he wasn't going to take a bath. That had been a white lie, like the one that Sally had told Sheriff Peterson. After double-checking to make sure that the drain was open so that the tub wouldn't overflow, Billy tightened the straps on his backpack, climbed on top of the toilet, pushed up the sash, and slipped out the window, leaving no one the wiser. Billy knew that his brother and Sally might only be talking for a few minutes, so he had to run as fast as he could around the motel to where the Studebaker was parked. He ran so fast, when he climbed into the trunk and lowered the lid, he could hear his heart beating in his chest. When Duchess had told Billy how he and Wooly had hidden in the trunk of the warden's car, Billy had asked how they'd gotten out again. Duchess had explained that he had brought along a spoon in order to pop the latch. So before climbing into the Studebaker's trunk, Billy had taken his jackknife out of his backpack. Then he had also taken out his flashlight because it was going to be dark in the trunk once the lid was closed. Billy wasn't afraid of the dark, but Duchess had said how difficult it had been to pop the latch without being able to see it. We came this close, Duchess said, holding his thumb and finger an inch apart, to riding all the way back to Salina without even getting a glimpse of Nebraska. Switching on his flashlight, Billy took a quick look at Wooly's watch to check the time. It was 3:30. Then he switched off the flashlight and waited. A few minutes later, he heard the car door open and close, the engine start, and they were on their way. Back in the motel room, when Emmett had told Billy that it was probably for the best if he stayed behind, Billy hadn't been surprised. Emmett often thought it was for the best that Billy remained behind while he was going someplace else, like when he went into the courthouse in Morgan in order to be sentenced by Judge Scomer. I think it's for the best, he'd said to Billy, that you wait out here with Sally. Or when they were at the depot in Lewis and Emmett had gone to find out about the freight trains to New York. Or when they were on the West Side Elevated and he had gone looking for Duchess's father. In the third paragraph of the introduction to his Compendium of Heroes, Adventurers, and Other Intrepid Travelers, Professor Abernathy says the hero often leaves his friends and family behind when setting out on an exploit. He leaves his friends and family behind because he is concerned about exposing them to peril, and because he has the courage to face the unknown by himself. That's why Emmett often thought it best for Billy to remain behind. But Emmett didn't know about Xenos. In chapter 24 of his compendium, Professor Abernathy says, as long as there have been great men who have accomplished great things, there have been storytellers eager to recount their exploits. But whether it was Hercules or Theseus, Caesar or Alexander, what feats these men accomplished, what victories they achieved, what adversities they overcame, would never have been possible without the contributions of Xenos. Although Xenos sounds like it might be the name of a figure from history, like Xerxes or Xenophon, Xenos is not the name of a person at all. Xenos is a word from ancient Greek that means foreigner and stranger, guest and friend, or more simply, the other. As Professor Abernathy says, Xenos is the one on the periphery in the unassuming garb whom you hardly notice. Throughout history, he has appeared in many guises, as a watchman or attendant, a messenger or page, a shopkeeper, waiter, or vagabond. Though usually unnamed, for the most part unknown, and too often forgotten, Xenos always shows up at just the right time, in just the right place, in order to play his essential role in the course of events. That's why when Emmett had suggested it was for the best that Billy stay behind while he went in search of Wooly and Duchess, Billy had no choice but to sneak out the window and hide in the trunk. 13 minutes after they had left the motel, the Studebaker came to a stop, and the driver's door opened and closed. Billy was about to pop the latch of the trunk when he smelled the fumes of gasoline. They must be at a filling station, he thought, and Emmett is asking for directions. The Woolly had put a big red star on Billy's map to show the location of his family's house. The map was drawn at too big a scale to include the local roads. So while Emmett knew he had reached the vicinity of Woolly's house, he didn't know exactly where it was. Listening carefully, Billy heard his brother call out thanks to someone. Then the door opened and closed, and they were driving again. 12 minutes later, the Studebaker took a turn and began moving slower and slower until it rolled to a stop. Then the engine went off, and the driver's door opened and closed again. This time, Billy decided he would wait at least 5 minutes before trying to pop the latch. Training his flashlight beam on Wooly's watch, he saw that it was now 4:02. At 4:07, he heard his brother calling out for Wooly and Duchess, followed by a screen door slam. Emmett had probably gone inside the house, thought Billy, but he waited another 2 minutes. When it was 4:09, he popped the latch and climbed out. He put his jackknife and flashlight back in his backpack back on his back, and quietly closed the trunk. The house was bigger than just about any house that Billy had ever seen. At its near end was the screen door that Emmett must have gone through. Quietly, Billy climbed the steps of the stoop, peeked through the screen, and let himself inside, being sure not to let the door slam behind him. The first room he entered was a storage area with all sorts of things that you would use outside, like boots and raincoats, skates and rifles. On the wall were the 10 rules for closing the house. Billy could tell the list was written in the order in which you were supposed to do things, but he wondered about the last item, the one that said, "Go home." After a moment, Billy decided it must have been put there in jest. Poking his head out of the storage room, Billy could see his brother at the end of the hallway, staring at the ceiling of a large room. Emmett would do that sometimes, stop and stare at a room in order to understand how it had been built. After a moment, Emmett climbed a set of stairs. When Billy could hear his brother's footsteps overhead, he snuck down the hallway and into the large room. As soon as he saw the fireplace big enough for everyone to gather around, Billy knew exactly where he was. Through the windows, he could see the porch with the overhanging roof, under which you could sit on rainy afternoons and on top of which you could lie on warm summer nights. Upstairs, there would be enough rooms for friends and family to visit for the holidays, and there in the corner was the special spot for the Christmas tree. Behind the staircase was a room with a long table and chairs. That must be the dining room, thought Billy, where Woolly gave the Gettysburg Address. Crossing the large room and entering the opposite hallway, Billy poked his head into the first room that he passed. It was the study, right where Woolly had drawn it. While the large room had been neat and tidy, the study was not. It was a mess, with books and papers scattered about, and a bust of Abraham Lincoln lying on the floor under a painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. On a chair near the bust were a hammer and some screwdrivers, and there were scratches all across the front of the safe. Woolly and Duchess must have been trying to get into the safe with the hammer and screwdrivers, thought Billy, but it wasn't going to work. A safe was made of steel and designed to be impenetrable. If you could open a safe with a hammer and screwdrivers, then it wouldn't be a safe. The door of the safe had 4 dials, each of which showed the numbers 0 through 9. That meant there were 10,000 different possible combinations. Duchess and Woolly would have been better off trying all 10,000 by starting with 0000 and working their way up to 9999, thought Billy. That would have taken less time than trying to break in with the hammer and screwdrivers. Even better, though, would be to guess the combination that Woolly's great-grandfather had chosen. It took Billy 6 tries. Once the door of the safe was open, it reminded Billy of the box at the bottom of his father's bureau, in that there were important papers inside, just a lot more of them. But under the shelf, with all of the important papers, Billy counted 15 stacks of $50 bills. Billy remembered that Woolly's great-grandfather had put $150,000 in his safe. That meant that each stack was made up of $10,000. Stacks of $10,000, thought Billy, in a safe with 10,000 possible combinations. Closing the door of the safe, Billy turned away, but then turned back again in order to spin the dials. Leaving the study, Billy continued down the hallway and went into the kitchen. It was neat and tidy, except for an empty soda pop bottle and a can of beans that had a spoon sticking straight up out of it like the stick on a candy apple. The only other sign that someone had been in the kitchen was the envelope tucked between the salt and pepper shakers on the table. The envelope, which said, "To be opened in the event of my absence," had been left there by Wooly. Billy could tell it had been left by Wooly because the handwriting on the envelope matched the handwriting on Wooly's drawing of the house. As Billy was putting the envelope back between the salt and pepper shakers, he heard the sound of metal hitting metal. Tiptoeing down the hallway and peeking through the door of the study, he saw Duchess swinging an axe at the safe. He was about to explain to Duchess about the 10,000 combinations when he heard his brother's footsteps thumping down the stairs. Running back down the hallway, Billy slipped back into the kitchen and out of sight. Once Emmett was inside the study, Billy couldn't hear what his brother was saying, but he could tell that he was angry from the tone of his voice. After a moment, Billy heard what sounded like a scuffle. Then Emmett emerged from the study, holding Duchess by the elbow. As Emmett marched him down the hallway, Duchess was speaking quickly about something that Wooly had chosen for himself for his own reasons. Then Emmett marched Duchess into the storage room. Following quickly but quietly down the hallway, Billy peeked around the doorframe of the storage room in time to hear Duchess tell Emmett why they shouldn't go to the cops. Then Emmett pushed Duchess out the door. In Chapter 1 of the Compendium of Heroes, Adventurers, and Other Intrepid Travelers, after the part where Professor Abernathy explains how many of the greatest adventure stories start in medias res, he goes on to explain the tragic flaws of classical heroes. "All classical heroes," he says, "however strong or wise or courageous they may be, have some flaw in their character which leads to their undoing." For Achilles, the fatal flaw had been anger. When he was angry, Achilles could not contain himself. Even though it had been foretold that he might die during the Trojan War, once his friend Patroclus was killed, Achilles returned to the battlefield blinded by a black and murderous rage. And that's when he was struck by the poisonous arrow. Billy understood that his brother had the same flaw as Achilles. Emmett was not a reckless person. He rarely raised his voice or showed impatience. But when something happened to make him angry, the force of his fury could come to such a boil that it resulted in an injudicious act with irreversible consequences. According to Billy's father, that's what Judge Scomer had said Emmett was guilty of when he had hit Jimmy Snyder. An injudicious act with irreversible consequences. Through the screen door, Billy could see that Emmett was coming to a boil right now. His face was growing red, and having taken Duchess by the shirt, he was shouting. He was shouting that there was no trust fund, no inheritance, no money in the safe. Then he shoved Duchess to the ground. "This must be it," thought Billy. "This is the time and place at which I needed to be in order to play my essential role in the course of events." So Billy opened the screen door and told his brother that there was money in the safe. But when Emmett turned around, Duchess hit him on the head with a stone, and Emmett fell to the ground. He fell to the ground just as Jimmy Snyder had. "Emmett!" Billy shouted. And Emmett must have heard Billy because he began to get up onto his knees. Then Duchess was suddenly at the doorway, pushing Billy inside, locking the door, and talking quickly. "Why did you hit Emmett?" Billy said. "Why did you hit him, Duchess? You shouldn't have hit him." Duchess swore he wouldn't do it again. But then he went back to talking quickly. He was talking about something called a snafu, and then about the safe, and Wooly, and the Yankees. When Emmett began banging on the storage room door, Duchess pushed Billy into the hallway, and when Emmett's banging stopped, Duchess started talking again, this time about the authorities and the house in California. And suddenly, Billy felt like he had been here before. The tightness of Duchess's grip and the urgency with which he was speaking made Billy feel like he was back on the West Side elevated in the dark in the hands of Pastor John. "We're going to talk to Emmett," said Duchess. "We're going to talk with him all about it, Billy, but for the moment, it's just you and me." Then Billy understood. Emmett wasn't there. Ulysses wasn't there. Sally wasn't there. Once again, he was alone and forsaken. Forsaken by everyone, including his maker. And whatever happened next rested only in his hands. Opening his eyes, Billy kicked Duchess as hard as he could. In the instant, Billy could feel Duchess's grip release. Then Billy was running down the hallway. He was running down the hallway to the hiding place under the stairs. He found the door with a tiny latch right where Wooly had said it was. The doorway was about half the size of a normal doorway and had a triangular top because it had been cut to fit under the staircase. But it was tall enough for Billy. Slipping inside, he pulled the door closed and held his breath. A moment later, he could hear Duchess calling his name. Billy could tell that Duchess was only a few feet away, but he wouldn't be able to find Billy. As Wooly had said, no one ever thought to look in the hiding place under the stairs, because it was right there in front of them. Emmett. After trying the muckroom door and finding it bolted, Emmett ran around the back of the house and tried the door that led into the dining room. When he found that door locked, and then the kitchen door too, he was through trying doors. Removing his belt, he wrapped it around his right hand so that the buckle was on top of his knuckles. Then he smashed one of the panes of glass in the door. Using the metal surface of the buckle, he knocked away the remaining shards that jutted from the frame. Sticking his left hand through the cleared pane, he unlocked the door. The belt he left wrapped around his fist, thinking it might come in handy right where it was. As Emmett stepped into the kitchen, he saw Duchess's figure at the far end of the hallway turning a corner at a sprint and disappearing into the muckroom, without Billy. Emmett didn't run in pursuit. Understanding that Billy had broken free, he no longer felt a sense of peril. What he felt now was inevitability. No matter how fast Duchess ran, no matter where he ran to, it was inevitable that Emmett would have his hands upon him. But as Emmett left the kitchen, he heard glass breaking. It wasn't the sound of a window pane. It was a sheet of glass. A moment later, Duchess reappeared at the other end of the hallway, holding one of the rifles. That Duchess had a rifle didn't change anything for Emmett. Slowly but unhesitantly, he began walking toward Duchess, and Duchess walked toward him. When they were both about 10 feet short of the staircase, they stopped, leaving 20 feet between them. Duchess was holding the rifle in one hand, with the barrel pointing at the ground, his finger on the trigger. From the way he held the rifle, Emmett could tell that Duchess had held one before. But that didn't change anything either. "Put down the rifle," he said. "I can't do that, Emmett. Not until you calm down and start talking sense." "Sense is what I've been talking, Duchess. For the first time in a week, willing or unwilling, you're going to the police station." Duchess looked genuinely frustrated. "Because of Wooly?" "Not because of Wooly. Then why?" "Because the cops think you clobbered someone back in Morgan with a 2x4 and then put Ackerley in the hospital." Now Duchess looked dumbfounded. "What are you talking about, Emmett? Why would I hit some guy in Morgan? I've never been there in my life. And as to Ackerley, the list of people who'd like to put him in the hospital must be 1,000 pages long." "It really doesn't matter whether you did these things or not, Duchess. What matters is that the cops think you did them, and that I was somehow involved. As long as they're looking for you, they'll be looking for me. So you'll have to turn yourself in and sort it out with them." Emmett took a step forward. But this time Duchess raised the rifle so that the barrel was pointing at his chest. In the back of his mind, Emmett knew that he should be taking the threat from Duchess seriously. Like Townhouse had said, when Duchess was intent on something, everyone on the periphery was at risk. Whether his intentions now were focused on avoiding Selena, or obtaining the money from the safe, or seeing to the unfinished business with his father, in the heat of the moment, Duchess was perfectly capable of doing something as stupid as pulling a trigger. And if Emmett got himself shot, what would happen to Billy? But before Emmett could acknowledge the merits of this train of thought, before he had the chance to even hesitate, out of the corner of his eye, he noticed a fedora on the cushion of a high-backed chair. And the memory of Duchess sitting at the piano in Ma Bell's lounge with his hat tilted back on his head in that cocksure manner gave Emmett a new surge of anger that restored his sense of inevitability. Emmett would have Duchess in his hands. He would take him to the police, and soon enough, Duchess would be on his way back to Selena, or Topeka, or wherever they wanted to send him. Emmett resumed walking, closing the gap between them. "Emmett," said Duchess, with an expression of anticipatory regret, "I don't want to shoot you, but I will shoot you if you leave me no choice." When they were 3 paces apart, Emmett stopped. It wasn't the threat of the rifle or the plea from Duchess that made him stop. It was the fact that 10 feet beyond Duchess, Billy had appeared. He must have been hiding somewhere behind the staircase. Now he was moving quietly into the open, so that he could see what was happening. Emmett wanted to signal Billy that he should return to wherever he'd been hiding, to signal him without making Duchess aware. But it was too late. Duchess had noted the change in Emmett's expression and glanced back to see what was behind him. When Duchess realized it was Billy, he took two steps to the side and rotated 45 degrees so that he could still see Emmett while training the rifle's barrel on Billy. "Stay there," Emmett said to his brother. "That's right, Billy. Don't make a move. Then your brother won't make a move, and I won't make a move, and we can talk this through together."
"Don't worry," said Billy to Emmett. "He can't shoot me."
"Billy, you don't know what Duchess will or won't do."
"No," said Billy. "I don't know what Duchess will or won't do, but I do know that he can't shoot me, because he can't read."
"What?" said Emmett and Duchess together, the one perplexed, the other offended.
"Who says I can't read?" demanded Duchess.
"You did," explained Billy. "First you said that small print gave you a headache, then you said that reading in cars made you queasy, then you said that you were allergic to books."
Billy turned to Emmett.
"He says it that way because he's too ashamed to admit that he can't read, just like he's too ashamed to admit that he can't swim."
As Billy was talking, Emmett kept his attention on Duchess, and he could see that Duchess was growing red. Maybe it was from shame, thought Emmett, but more likely from resentment.
"Billy," Emmett cautioned, "whether or not Duchess can read doesn't make any difference right now. Why don't you just leave this to me?"
But Billy was shaking his head.
"It does make a difference, Emmett. It makes a difference because Duchess doesn't know the rules for closing the house."
Emmett looked at his brother for a moment. Then he looked at Duchess. Poor, misguided, illiterate Duchess. Taking the last three strides, Emmett put his hands on the rifle and yanked it from Duchess's grip. Duchess began talking a mile a minute about how he would never have pulled the trigger, not against a Watson, not in a million years. But over Duchess's talking, what Emmett heard was his brother saying a single word, saying his name in the manner of a reminder. "Emmett." And Emmett understood. On the lawn of the county courthouse, Emmett had made a promise to his brother, a promise he intended to keep. So as Duchess rattled on about all the things he would never have done, Emmett counted to 10. And as he counted, he could feel the old heat subsiding. He could feel the anger seeping away until he didn't feel angry at all. Then raising the butt of the rifle, he hit Duchess in the face, giving it everything he had.
"I think you should look at this now," insisted Billy.
After Duchess had hit the ground, Billy had gone to the kitchen. When he returned a moment later, Emmett told him to sit on the staircase and not move a muscle. Then taking Duchess under the armpits, he began dragging him through the living room. His plan was to drag him out of the muck room, down the stoop, and across the lawn to the Studebaker so that he could drive him to the closest police station and dump him at their door. He hadn't gotten more than two steps when Billy had spoken. Looking up, Emmett could see that his brother was holding an envelope. Another letter from their father, Emmett thought with a touch of exasperation, or another postcard from their mother, or another map of America.
"I can look at it later," said Emmett.
"No," said Billy, shaking his head.
"No, I think you should look at it now."
Dropping Duchess back on the floor, Emmett went over to his brother.
"It's from Wooly," said Billy, "to be opened in the event of his absence."
A little stunned, Emmett looked at the inscription on the envelope.
"He is absent, isn't he?" asked Billy.
Emmett hadn't quite decided how or whether he should tell his brother about Wooly. But from the way Billy said absent, it seemed like he already knew.
"Yes," said Emmett. "He is."
Sitting on the steps beside Billy, Emmett opened the envelope. Inside was a handwritten note on a piece of Wallace Wolcott's stationery. Emmett didn't know if this Wallace Wolcott was Wooly's great-grandfather or his grandfather or his uncle, but it didn't matter whose stationery it was. Dated the 20th of June, 1954, and addressed to whom it may concern, the letter stated that the undersigned, being of sound mind and body, left one-third of his $150,000 trust fund
to Mr. Emmett Watson, 1/3 to Mr. Duchess Hewitt, and 1/3 to Mr. William Watson, to do with as they pleased. It was signed, Most Sincereliest, Wallace Wolcott Martin. As Emmett closed the letter, he realized that his brother had read it over his shoulder. Was Willie sick? He asked. Like Dad? Yes, said Emmett. He was sick. I thought he might be when he gave me his uncle's watch, because it was a watch for handing down. Billy thought for a moment. Is that why you told Duchess that Willie wanted to be taken home? Yes, said Emmett. That's what I meant. I think you were right about that, said Billy, nodding in agreement. But you were wrong about the money in the safe. Without waiting for Emmett to respond, Billy got up and walked down the hallway. Reluctantly, Emmett followed his brother back into Mr. Wolcott's office and over to the safe. By the bookshelves was a piece of furniture that looked like the first three steps of a staircase. Dragging it in front of the safe, Billy climbed the steps, rotated the four dials, turned the handle, and opened the door. For a moment, Emmett was speechless. How do you know the combination, Billy? Did Wooly tell it to you? No, Wooly didn't tell it to me, but he told me how his great-grandfather loved the 4th of July more than any other holiday. So the first combination I tried was 1776. Then I tried 7476, because that's one way of writing the 4th of July. After that, I tried 1732, the year that George Washington was born. But then I remembered that Wooly's great-grandfather said that while Washington, Jefferson, and Adams had the vision to found the Republic, it was Mr. Lincoln who had the courage to perfect it. So I tried 1809, the year that President Lincoln was born, and 1865, the year that he died. That's when I realized it must be 1119, because November 19th was the day of the Gettysburg Address. Here, he said, stepping down from the stairs. Come take a look. Pushing the stairs to the side, Emmett approached the safe, where under a shelf of papers, thousands of brand-new $50 bills were neatly arranged in stacks. Emmett ran a hand over his mouth. $150,000, he thought. $150,000 of old Mr. Wolcott's wealth had been handed down to Wooly, and now Wooly had handed it down to them. He had handed it down by means of a last will and testament that was duly signed and dated. There could be no question of Wooly's intent. In that regard, Duchess had been quite right. It was Wooly's money, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do with it. Having been found temperamentally unfit to use it himself, in his absence he wanted his friends to use it as they pleased. But what would happen if Emmett finished dragging Duchess to the Studebaker and dumped him at the police station? As much as Emmett hated to admit it, Duchess had been right about that too. Once Duchess was in the hands of the cops, and it became clear that Wooly was dead, the wheels of Emmett's and Billy's future would grind to a halt. Police and investigators would descend upon the house, followed by family members and attorneys. Circumstances would be studied, inventories taken, intentions second-guessed, endless questions asked. And any turns of good fortune would be viewed with the utmost suspicion. In another few moments, Emmett would close the door to Mr. Wolcott's safe. That was a certainty. But once the door was closed, two different futures would be possible. In one, the contents of the safe would remain untouched. In the other, the space below the shelf would be empty. Wooly wanted the best for his friends, observed Billy. Yes, he did. For you and me, said Billy. And for Duchess, too. Once the decision was made, Emmett knew they would need to work quickly, putting things in order and leaving as few traces as possible. After closing the door to the safe, Emmett gave Billy the task of cleaning up the office while he saw to the rest of the house. First, having gathered up the tools that Duchess had assembled, the hammer, screwdrivers, and axe, he carried them outside past the breached dory to the workshed. Back inside, Emmett went to the kitchen. Certain that Wooly would never have eaten beans out of a can, Emmett put the empty can and Pepsi bottle in a paper bag to be carted out. Then he cleaned the spoon and returned it to the silverware drawer. The broken pane of glass in the kitchen didn't worry him. The authorities would assume that Wooly had broken the pane in order to get inside the locked house. But the rifle cabinet was another matter. That would be more likely to raise questions, serious questions. After returning the rifle to its place in the cabinet, Emmett removed the croquet ball, Then he repositioned the stack of Adirondack chairs to make it look like they had toppled over and crashed through the glass. Now it was time to deal with Duchess. Taking him under the arms again, Emmett dragged him down the hallway, out of the muckroom, and onto the grass. When Emmett and Billy had decided to take their share of the money and leave Duchess behind with his, Billy had made Emmett promise that he wouldn't hurt Duchess any more than he already had. But every minute that passed increased the risk that Duchess would regain consciousness and pose a whole new set of problems. Emmett had to put him somewhere that would slow him down for a few hours, or at least long enough for Billy and Emmett to finish their work and be well on their way. The trunk of the Cadillac? He wondered. The problem with the trunk was that once Duchess regained consciousness, he would either be able to get out of it quickly or not at all. Bad outcomes both. The work shed? No, there'd be no way to secure its doors from the outside. As Emmett was looking toward the shed, another idea presented itself. An interesting idea. But suddenly, at Emmett's feet, Duchess emitted a groan. Shit, said Emmett to himself. Looking down, he could see that Duchess was moving his head lightly from side to side, on the verge of coming to. As Duchess emitted another groan, Emmett looked back over his shoulder to make sure that Billy wasn't there. Then bending over, he lifted Duchess by the collar with his left hand and punched him in the face with his right. With Duchess again at rest, Emmett dragged him in the direction of the shed. 20 minutes later, they were ready to go. Unsurprisingly, Billy had done a perfect job of restoring the office. Every book was back on its shelf, every paper in its stack, every drawer in its slot. The only thing he hadn't replaced was the bust of Abraham Lincoln, because it was too heavy. When Emmett picked it up and began looking around for a place to set it down, Billy crossed to the desk. Here, he said, placing a finger on the spot where the faintest outline of the sculpture's base could be seen. As Billy waited by the kitchen door, Emmett locked the doors to the front porch and the muckroom, and then made a final swing through the house. Returning to the bedroom upstairs, he stood in the doorway. His intention had been to leave everything exactly as he'd found it. But seeing the empty brown bottle, Emmett picked it up and put it in his pocket. Then he said one last goodbye to Wallace Woolley Martin. As he was closing the door, Emmett noticed his old book bag on a chair and realized that the one he had loaned Duchess must be somewhere in the house as well. After checking all the bedrooms, Emmett searched the living room and found it lying on the floor next to a couch where Duchess must have spent the night. Only as he was headed for the kitchen to join Billy did Emmett remember and retrieve the fedora from the high back chair. As they walked from the kitchen past the dock, Emmett showed Billy that Duchess was safe and sound. In the front seat of the Cadillac, he tossed Duchess's book bag and the hat. In the trunk of the Studebaker, he put 2 paper bags, one with the trash from the kitchen, the other with their share of Woolley's trust. As he was about to close the trunk, he was reminded that just 9 days before, he had been standing in the same spot when he received his father's legacies. The money and the quote from Emerson, which was half excuse, half exhortation. Having come 1,500 miles in the wrong direction, on the verge of traveling 3,000 more, Emmett believed that the power within him was new in nature, that no one but he could know what he was capable of, and that he had only just begun to know it himself. Closing the trunk, he joined Billy in the front seat, turned the key, and pushed the starter. "I had originally been thinking that we'd spend the night up here," Emmett said to his brother. "What do you say we pick up Sally and hit the road instead?"
"That's a good idea," said Billy. "Let's pick up Sally and hit the road."
As Emmett backed the car in an arc in order to face it toward the driveway, Billy was already studying his map, with a furrowed brow.
"What is it?" asked Emmett.
Billy shook his head. "This is the fastest route from where we are." Placing his fingertip on Woolley's big red star, Billy moved it along various roads headed in a southwestern trajectory from the Wolcotts to Saratoga Springs and Scranton, then westward to Pittsburgh, where they would finally rejoin the Lincoln Highway.
"What time is it?" asked Emmett.
Looking at Woolley's watch, Billy said that it was 1:55. Emmett pointed to a different road on the map.
"If we went back the way we came," he said, "we could start our journey in Times Square, and if we hurry, we could get there just as all the lights are coming on."
Billy looked up in his wide-eyed way.
"Could we, Emmett?
Could we really? But wouldn't that take us out of our way?
Emmett made a show of thinking for a second.
A little out of our way, I suppose. But what day is it?
It's the 21st of June.
Emmett put the Studebaker in gear. Then we've got 13 days to make the crossing, if we mean to be in San Francisco by the 4th of July.
Duchess. I returned to consciousness with a sensation of drifting, like one who's sitting in a boat on a sunny afternoon. And as it turned out, that's exactly where I was, sitting in a boat on a sunny afternoon. Giving my head a shake in order to clear it, I put my hands on the gunwales and hoisted myself up. The first thing I noted, I'll readily admit, was the natural beauty before me. Though I was never much of a country mouse, finding the great outdoors to be generally uncomfortable and occasionally inhospitable, there was something deeply satisfying about the scenery. What with the pine trees rising from the lake shore, and the sunlight cascading from the sky, and the surface of the water stirred by a gentle breeze, one couldn't help but sigh at the majesty of it all. But thanks to the ache in my keister, I was brought back to reality. Looking down, I could see that I was sitting on a pile of painted stones. Picking one of them up in order to consider it more closely, I realized that not only was there dried blood on my hand, there was dried blood all down the front of my shirt. Then I remembered. Emmett had hit me with the butt of the rifle. He had burst through the door while I was trying to open the safe. We'd had a difference of opinions, something of a scuffle, and a bit of tit-for-tat. In the interest of theatrics, I had brandished a gun, waving it in the general direction of Billy. But having leapt to the wrong conclusion about my intentions, Emmett had grabbed the rifle and let me have it. He may even have broken my nose, I thought, which would explain why I was having so much trouble breathing through my nostrils. As I reached up to give my injury a gingerly probe, I heard the engine of a car revving. Looking to my left, I saw the Studebaker, as yellow as a canary, backing up, idling, then roaring out of the Wolcott's Drive. "Wait!" I shouted. But as I leaned to my side in order to call Emmett's name, the boat took a dip toward the water. Lurching back, I carefully resumed my place in the center. Okay, I thought to myself, Emmett knocked me out with the rifle. But then rather than taking me to the police station as threatened, he set me adrift in a rowboat without a paddle. Why would he do that? Then my eyes narrowed. Because little Mr. Know-It-All had told him I couldn't swim, that's why. And by setting me adrift on the lake, the Watson brothers figured they would have all the time they needed to get into the safe and claim Wooly's inheritance for themselves. But even as I was having this ugly thought, a thought for which I will never be able to fully atone, I noticed the stacks of cash in the bow. Emmett had gotten into the old man's safe all right, just like I knew he would. But rather than stranding me empty-handed, he had left me with my rightful share. It was my rightful share, wasn't it? I mean, isn't that about what $50,000 would look like? Naturally curious, I began moving toward the front of the boat in order to do a quick accounting. But as I did so, the shifting of my weight lowered the front of the boat, and water began pouring in through a hole in the bow. Retreating quickly to my seat, the bow lifted, and the inrush stopped. This wasn't just any rowboat, I realized, as water sloshed about my feet. This was the rowboat that was being repaired by the boathouse, and that's why Emmett had loaded the stones in the stern, to keep the compromised bow above the waterline. The ingenuity of it, I thought with a smile. A boat with a hole and no oars in the middle of a lake. It was like a setup for Cousin Tikis. The only thing better would have been if Emmett had tied my hands behind my back or put me in cuffs. All right then, I said, feeling every bit up to the challenge. By my estimate, I was a few hundred feet from shore. If I leaned back, stuck my hands in the water, and paddled gently, I should be able to make my way safely to solid ground. Reaching my arms over the back of the boat turned out to be surprisingly awkward, and the water turned out to be surprisingly cold. In fact, every few minutes I had to interrupt my paddling in order to warm my fingers. But just as I was beginning to make progress, a late afternoon breeze began picking up, such that every time I took a break from paddling, I would find myself drifting back toward the center of the lake. To compensate, I started paddling a little faster and taking shorter breaks. But as if in response, the breeze blew harder, so much so that one of the bills flitted off the top of its stack and landed about 20 feet away on the surface of the water. Then off flitted another, and another. Paddling as fast as I could, I stopped taking breaks altogether. But the breeze kept blowing, and the bills kept taking flight, fluttering over the side of the boat, $50 at a crack. Having no other choice, I stopped paddling, rose to my feet, and started creeping forward. When I took my second little step, the bow dipped an inch too far and water began flowing in. I took a step back and the inflow stopped. There would be no doing this cautiously, I realized. I was going to have to make a grab for the cash, then retreat quickly back to the stern before too much water had entered the boat. Steadying myself with my arms before me, I prepared for the lunge. All it required was deftness. A quick motion combined with a gentle touch, like when you're removing a cork from a bottle. Exactly, I thought to myself. The whole endeavor shouldn't take more than 10 seconds. But without Billy to assist, I'd have to do the countdown on my own. At the word 10, I took the first step forward and the boat rocked to the right. At 9, I compensated by stepping to the left and the boat lurched left. At 8, what with all the rocking and lurching, I lost my balance and tumbled forward, landing right on top of the cache as water rushed in through the breach. Reaching for the gunwale, I tried to push myself up, but my fingers were so numb from the paddling that I lost my grip and fell forward again, whacking my broken nose on the bow. With a howl, I reflexively scrambled to my feet as the freezing water continued to rush in around my ankles. With all of my weight in the front of the boat and the stern rising up behind me, painted stones rolled toward my feet. The bow took another dip, and I went head over heels into the lake. Kicking at the depths with my feet and slapping at the surface with my arms, I tried to take a deep breath of air, but took a deep breath of water instead. Coughing and thrashing, I felt my head go under and my body begin to sink. Looking up through the dappled surface, I could see the shadows of the bills floating on the water like autumn leaves. Then the boat drifted over me, casting a much larger shadow, a shadow that began to extend outward in every direction. But just when it seemed as if the entire lake would be subsumed in darkness, a great curtain was raised, and I found myself standing on a crowded street in a busy metropolis, except that everyone around me was someone I knew, and all of them were frozen in place. Sitting together on a nearby bench were Wooly and Billy, smiling at the floor plan of the house in California. And there was Sally, leaning over a pram in order to tuck in the blanket of the child in her care. And there by the flower cart was Sister Sarah, looking wistful and forlorn. And right there, not more than 50 feet away, standing by the door of his bright yellow car, was Emmett, looking honorable and upright. "Emmett!" I called. But even as I did so, I could hear the distant chiming of a clock. Only it wasn't a clock, and it wasn't distant. It was the gold watch that had been tucked in the pocket of my vest, and that now was suddenly in my hand. Looking down at its face, I couldn't tell what time it was. But I knew that after another few chimes, the entire world would begin moving once again. So taking off my crooked hat, I bowed to Sarah and Sally. I bowed to Wooly and Billy. I bowed to the one and only Emmett Watson. And when the final chime sounded, I turned to them all in order to utter with my very last breath, "The rest is silence," just as Hamlet had. Or was that Iago? I never could remember. This is Eduardo Ballerini. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Lincoln Highway by Amor Towles. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Edited by Tidef Studios. Text copyright 2021 by Satology, Inc. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.